I want to start today's episode with a recording. The voice you can hear is of my father. It's recorded on my phone about 2 weeks after we learned that what initially appeared to be a shadow near his liver was actually stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Complaints about persistent stomach pains had landed him in hospital. And there, at around noon one morning in March, a doctor casually explained to me that my father had 3 months to live, at the most.
And with that money, we enjoyed in Sabesco. It was sticky, sticky, penny.
I pressed record soon afterwards as a way to hold on to my favourite person. The man who gave me my nose, my insistence on not taking life too seriously, and a love of words. But you won't hear many more of his words here, because even though I have multiple recordings of our family's storyteller-in-chief explaining the numerous branches of our family tree, retelling his life story and letting me in on never-before-heard family drama, I haven't, in the 3 years since he died, been able to bring myself to listen to these recordings. There's been a lot of talk about grief in the past 2 years, collective and individual grief. We've been mourning lost moments and people we've lost. And although my grief predates that, I too have been trying to figure out how to mourn and move on, 3 years after the loss of my life's central influence. And so today I want to explore how we deal with the shock of loss with Ami, a professional mourner who helps families in the earliest stages of their grief, and Taku in Zimbabwe, whose experience of loss was shaped by the restrictions caused by the COVID pandemic. I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and this is The Comb, a BBC World Service original podcast, where each week I comb the continent for stories that matter.
This is The Comb.
Ye ni The Comb.
The Comb, no.
Ni The Comb.
The Comb.
You know, with how he viewed my father, he was like a superman. He was like this strong guy. He was our pillar. And I always thought, my sister's not ready to lose a father. I'm not ready to lose a father. And
this is Taku. I want to start the episode with him because our stories share similarities. We're both Zimbabwean. We come from large extended families. And for both of us, our fathers played an outsized role in our lives.
He was that invincible guy. You'd think he's not going to die any other time. You know, you have plans in the future to do things for him. And he just goes in just that, like lightning, you know, so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll come to that loss, but first, a bit more about Taku.
Okay, so my name is Takunda Dangare. I'm 24 years of age. I stay in Harare, Zimbabwe, Hatfield, to be exact.
So Taku, tell me a little bit about your family.
Okay, so we are about 8 children in my family, but it's quite like an extended family type of situation.
And where do you sit in the lineup?
I'm the second from last, but I'm the last born male child. My father's name was Wilson Bangari.
And how would you describe him physically? What did he look like?
So he was short, very fit, dark in complexion. He always wanted to keep his fadeaway cut, even in his 60s. He always had his fadeaway cut. So I think that's how I would describe him.
And where would he go to maintain his fadeaway cut?
So, you know, funny thing, he would always go to any barbershop. At some point, I went to get my haircut. Without knowing, when I went to the salon, he was there. Imagine that. So he really was particular about how he presented himself, and he always had his dye on when his hair was turning white. So he always put his black dye to make sure that he's smart and presentable.
I'm going to post a photo of Taku's dad and his favorite fadeaway cut on our current Facebook page. Taku says growing up, he thought his father was a bit strict, but as he grew older, they grew closer.
Most of the time that we'd spend was after we had supper. You know, so we usually had supper as a family, and then my mom and my sister would go to sleep, and then it would be us, we'd watch the news together, argue about politics, argue about everything that's coming up on the TV. After that, if there's a soccer match, we watch a soccer match. So we'd usually, you know, spend maybe that 8 to 10 or 11 p.m. time together at home, just the two of us.
Taku says if there was one word to describe his father, it was...
very passionate. He wouldn't miss work for anything. And he would work very hard, that you'd see. He's not just working because of money, but he's working from the heart itself. And also maybe another example would be when he speaks to you about something, when he is trying to teach you about something, he really spoke from his heart and he really spoke wanting to see a change.
Outside of work, soccer and family, Taku's father had another passion.
He loved music. He loved music. Every day in the morning, we knew that in his bedroom, there would be music playing. Mm-hmm. So you'd definitely wake up because of that music every day.
Who would he be playing in the morning?
You would play, you know, the Charambas, the Oliver Mtukudzi.
Yes.
That was his. Exactly. That was his music. And also at church, he was part of the choir team. I remember they won a trophy at some point. And he was one of the few guys that were singing best. So it was literally him doing most of the stuff there. So he really loved music. He was really a man of music. Even on the night where he then passed, when we were going to the hospital with him in the car, he was singing. He was actually trying to say, you know what, don't sing because you know, you use much energy on that. But he was singing all the way.
What was he singing?
He was singing a gospel song.
So when did you first realize that your father was unwell?
So, you know, we just had some flu-ish symptoms at home. This was towards the end of the year. Remember, I had it went away. My sister also had it too, it went away. And also my dad at his work, he was sort of doing some renovations. So he was actively involved. So then he started sneezing, coughing. And we just thought it was just the flu that was in the house, and also him, man, doing the renovations, involved with dust, etc.
Was he ever tested for COVID at any point?
No, he wasn't. He would always say, I'm well, so don't take me to the hospital. So he woke up that day. He was really showing signs of being unwell. He said he was feeling weak.
Mm-hmm.
His whole body was weak, that he even struggled to bath. So that is when I was saying, you know, he's really unwell. So this is what he did. I think he saw it, that we were worried. He took us, he took my mom, he took me as well. We were in the bedroom with him. So he started saying, don't be worried, don't be stressed, I'm going to be okay. But you should always learn to be strong. You should not be shaken by such things. When someone gets sick, you should be strong for them. So whatever that happens or whatever that is going to happen, just be strong and always pray in every other situation, in everything. All of a sudden, I was scared at that moment. But when he told me that, I really became strong. And I was really thinking of finding help rather than really worrying about what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it really struck me. I cried a bit in his face. And he actually said, it's good that you're crying because you're hearing what I'm saying and you're understanding what I'm trying to tell you. He was the closest with my little sister. So, you know, my sister was seeing all this And she said to my sister, she said, come here close to me, hold my hand. My sister held his hand and she said, I want you to know that you're beautiful and I love you. So, you know, all these things were like, you know, when you're in the moment, you don't think about it. But now when I think of it, it's then I see, you know, the sequence of events. It was someone who was already saying goodbye in a way.
Taku, together with his mother, began the first of many frustrating and increasingly desperate attempts to get their father admitted to hospital.
So we went to a nearby hospital around close to where we live.
Mm-hmm.
Went out with him in the car. The doctors took him. They put him on oxygen. That's when they said that his oxygen levels are bad. So they did not test him. So they just looked at him, looked at his symptoms, and they said, this is COVID, and here we can't assist him. You have to go to the general hospital so that you get assistance. And I remember we tried to beg the doctor and say, oh, please just help him. Please just let him stay on oxygen so that maybe he gains a bit and then we can then go with him.
Mm.
But with the situation those days, unfortunately, they declined. They said no.
Eventually, Taku managed to get his father into a private facility that was treating people with COVID. But this was now hours later.
I think I didn't mention the time. I think we left home around 10 or 11. And that time now it was around 3 a.m., close to 4 a.m. And then that's when I got a place for him to be at. And we left him there. The nurses said, you know what, we're going to take care of him. You guys go back home, take your stuff, and then bring it in the morning so that we can take care of him and give him all that he needs. And Kim, this, when I left my father there, he actually thanked me when he was going off the car. And he was walking by himself,
yeah,
you know. And then 10 minutes later, the doctor tells me he's now very critical. And he says they're moving him to ICU, you know, to give him the best attention they can. I lost every power in me. And I was with my mom. I didn't know what to tell her, but I just ended up telling her. I couldn't really drive. I remember I was driving maybe 10 kilometers per hour. An hour later, that is when the doctor called me and they said, I'm sorry, your dad didn't make it. At that time, I didn't feel it or I didn't feel anything happen. But then my mom was on the side. She was next to me in the car. I didn't know what to say to her. I didn't know what to tell her or how to tell her.
In the case of my father, he was able to tell us exactly how he wanted to be buried and what type of funeral he wanted. And we gave him that, a 3-day ceremony in our hometown Kwekwe, packed with family and friends. That wasn't the case for Taku.
There was no proper funeral. And at the time of the burial, it was just a matter of going to the mortuary where he was. And we identified the body. And, you know, Kim, I think that process of having to do a body viewing, having to have the body arrive at home, sleep at home, you know, the whole night at home. So culturally, it's like the body has to come home so that he can have the final rest, you know, the final night at home. But that did not happen. We only got to do the burial because we actually asked for it. You know, that we can't bury our father without seeing that it's actually him. So it was just me and my brother. And that was my first time to get into a mortuary, to get to identify a body, you know. So that happened. My mother never got to see him. My sister, no one else got to see him. So it only happened. Everything was so abrupt and rushed that we got to the mortuary. From there, we were already on the way to the village to bury him. So he never came home, or neither did you have time with the coffin to really mourn and cry. And when we got there,
everything was all set, like the grave was already dug, so they wouldn't even waste time. You get there, they take the body, they put it into the grave, and everything is done, and everyone is told to disperse. I think what I lost is not being able to really grieve and mourn him.
This is where Taku is today, trying to work through his unresolved grief and being unable to give his father the funeral he deserved. So I wanted to talk to someone who helps to give a voice to loss and the experience of it.
I'm Amidokli from Ghana, to be precise, Volta region. A very nice village in the Volta region called Achiavi, that's where I'm from. But I was born and bred in Ashanti region, that is Kumasi. I'm 58 years old, a widow with three children. I'm a professional mourner.
And what does a professional mourner do, Ami? Explain what your work involves.
Okay, a professional mourner is someone who normally cry in the funeral grounds whenever someone is dead. In our Ghana here, when someone died, okay, you have to cry, and some people don't know how to cry. So they come for us and we have to do it for them.
For the past decade, Ami has been invited to dozens of funerals in Ghana and paid to cry on behalf of strangers.
Oh, we have gone to so many funerals. Some of them are widows, someone's husband will die, someone's mother, someone's father. Someone's even brother or sister would die.
Now, I'll be honest. When I first read about professional mourners, I was a little bit skeptical. I struggled to understand why you'd want to hire a stranger to cry on behalf of someone you knew and loved. What benefit is there, I wondered, in the performance of grief? Ami says, ideally, people wouldn't need her services.
We all have to learn how to cry, so that when your loved one dies, you don't have to go and hire somebody and pay money for the person to come and cry for you. If you know how to cry and your loved one died, you have to cry yourself. Because it's the custom of Ghana here that when someone dies, you have to cry. When you cry, it helps. So here, when someone dies and you are not crying, you don't cry out, we will tell you will fall sick. So you have to cry out and pour all the pains out.
Think of Ami's role as that of a type of grief guide. She says her presence not only helps the family feel supported, but also by taking on her role as a mourner, it signals to others that they too can and should cry. For a family member not to cry at a loved one's funeral can be interpreted as having not cared for the person, so it's not uncommon for people to weep loudly and wail.
Abroad people, you cry in a handkerchief. You use your handkerchief to cry. When the tears are coming, then you use handkerchief to clean it. But here, when you are crying, you don't have to use handkerchief to cry. You have to say words. That words will move people.
Ami says heightened displays of emotion help elicit tears in others and ultimately helps those left behind find healing.
You don't have to cry alone. No. You have to say some words for those there to feel pains or to feel for you.
What are those words? Could you explain, for someone who is not from Ghana, can you explain what you mean by there are some words you have to say? What are you communicating there? What are the main things you're saying in that?
I'm saying, you see, my husband, since he was anything to me, I was saying that, oh, who will give me food? I'll go with you. Oh. Okay, who did you leave me for? The children, who will look after them? And when you are crying, saying those words, when those there will feel sympathy for you, they will all cry for you.
Mm-hmm. The tradition of professional mourners, or mourologists as they are known, spans across cultures, from Albania to Venezuela, and dates back centuries, going as far back as ancient Rome. Different cultures have long relied on hired hands to aid the living in saying goodbye to those they've lost. Ami's journey started 29 years ago. At the time, she was happily married. How would you describe him? What was he like?
Oh, he was a handsome guy. Very handsome. Very, 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 very handsome. Very tall. Everything women need in a man, he has. I loved him a lot.
Not long after they were married, Ami's husband was involved in a car accident.
In fact, that day it was Sunday dawn, when I was in my room sleeping with my two children, that's my two girls, and someone entered the room without my knowledge. When I got up, I found out that it was my mother-in-law and her sister. So I asked them, what are they doing in my room? And they told me they came to visit someone in my area. So
they were there to tell her that her husband had been killed.
I heard my mother screaming. So I got out in the room and asked my mother, what is happening? And my mother-in-law bring out my two children, started crying, mentioning my husband's name.
Ami found herself a widow at the age of 28, with three children under the age of 7.
It was very difficult that time. I always wake up in the morning crying. I always cried. Whenever someone dies and I go to the funeral, I have to cry. I cried a lot because my kids were young. And there was nobody to help me. I have to struggle myself to bring up the child, to look after the child. So it was very difficult. It was not easy.
Soon after the death of her husband, a lady approached Ami. The woman had seen the outpouring of grief that followed Ami's husband's death. And she wondered if Ami and her friends might be able to do the same for her mother.
When she came to me, she offered us some money and begging us that we have to do it for her. And when we do it, she will give us this amount. So I asked my friends and we all agreed to go and do it. So after doing that one, some people also trying to call us. That's why it came to business. Normally, we didn't intend to do it as a business, but when our friends invite us and give us some money, we found out that when we turn it into business, it will help us. That's how we turn it into business.
And this is how Ami began her role as what she calls a funeral contractor, joined by 7 other widows. Ami, how is it that you can cry, you can just start crying? Is it because you think of your own pain? How do you, because a lot of people struggle to cry.
Even right now, when I was talking to you about my husband, I feel like crying right now.
I'm sorry, Ami. Are you someone who's always been very sensitive?
Yes, very sensitive. You see tears coming like water coming from pipe. Me, Ami, I like crying. I don't know how to explain, but I like crying.
Why do you like crying? Because people don't really like crying. Why do you like that?
But I don't know. I was born with it. When something is happening to me or somebody and I can't help that person, you will see me crying. If I have to help the person, I couldn't help the person, it will pain me inside. Then I will start crying.
Not everyone likes the idea of bringing in professional mourners, that uneasy coexistence of commerce and loss. Ami admits that she has come in for some criticism.
So many people criticize us, that's why, but we don't care. Since it was not you, we don't care. All that we care is someone has given us money to go and cry for him or her. That's what we are going to do. We don't care about you people talking about it, no.
But Ami feels that she is providing a vital service, one that she takes seriously. She says before she attends any funeral, she prepares by getting the history and background of the person. She says it helps her to get ready. Ultimately, for Ami, it's about helping the family express the sorrow they cannot yet give voice to. She gives an example of a funeral she attended on behalf of some sons who had lost their mother.
You know, men didn't know how to cry. So we have to go and stand as her daughters and cry for her. After doing that, the men thank us very much that we have lift up the image of their mother.
I want to go back to Taku, who we heard right at the beginning of the episode, who's still reckoning with the sudden loss of his father.
You know, it's better, Kim, when someone gets sick and you see the process. You see the whole thing. You get an appreciation to say, you know what, this person was really, really sick. But this was in a space of maybe 3-4 days, you know, without him being that much critical. So it was really a shock, and you know, I wouldn't wish it for anyone to go through that.
Yeah. Do you know, Taku, it's interesting that you say that. Now, this is something I've thought about a lot. A scenario I've circled around endlessly. Would it have been better for my dad to have gone quickly? Or was it better to have had that knowledge and time like Taku wishes to have had with his father? Having seen what cancer did to my dad, the way it shrunk and ultimately silenced him in what felt like painful slow motion, I'd have to go for answer C, neither of the above. For me at least, seeing it coming didn't make me any more prepared for the aftermath. In the years since, I found myself doing a type of grief audit, calculating whether I could have done more of this and perhaps less of that. Could I have called him more or spent more time with him? Was I an okay daughter? Was I a good one? Taku has his own version of that audit.
We would talk a lot, you know, those times I was telling you that we'd spend time, we'd really talk a lot about life, you know, everything. And he would always say, I want to be shown that I'm loved when I'm still here. Not when I die and then you want to, you know, put my pictures in the newspapers, you want to put them on your status and say that I love you and do things for me, buy a nice coffin and all that. Show me now that you love me, not when I die.
Thanks for listening to The Comb. And if you enjoy this episode, then please do tell a friend or two about us. And if you can, please also leave us a review on the podcast app you're listening on. It helps more people to find out about The Comb. And plus, I love scrolling through your reviews. And if you have any story ideas or just want to say hi, then email me at thecomb@bbc.com. This episode was produced by me, Kim Chakaneta, and Mary Goodhart. The sound design is by Rob Wilson. Piers Lynch is our editor. Our studio manager is Philip Bull. A special thanks to Kundai, Samuka, and Nyasha, who share their stories of loss with me. And thanks also to Shingai Nyoka, Chris Charamba, and Sule Lanza for all their help with this episode. This episode is dedicated to Taku's father, Wilson Dangari Sakupwanya, and mine, Maxwell Muzaninamu Chakaneta.